KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Reversing 7 decades of U.S. policy in the Middle East, President Trump announced yesterday that his administration will recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. The decision, which one Palestinian diplomat called a kiss of death for a two-state solution, sparked a wave of violent protests across the West Bank and Gaza today and led to calls by the Palestinian Authority for a general strike. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu praised the decision, which he called courageous and just, and we'll discuss the implications of the policy shift for Mideast stability and peace. Let me tell you who is joining us. We want to welcome, first of all, Greg Meyer, who is national security correspondent for NPR. He was based in Jerusalem from 2000 to 2007. Good to have you with us, Greg Meyer. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Michael. Appreciate it.
And I'm also going to welcome Youssef Taha of the BBC's Middle East desk, who joins us this morning as well. And we welcome you, Youssef Taha.
Thank you.
Let me begin, Greg Meyer, if I may, with you. And let's just talk about this from the Palestinian standpoint, since now there's been a call for a third intifada by the leader of Hamas, and there's a great deal of protest. Palestinians pretty much, and I'm talking about, of course, West Bank Palestinians under Fatah, or under the Palestinian Authority, regarded East Jerusalem as a capital of their future state. So from their perspective, this is, isn't it tantamount to the end of the peace process?
Yeah, essentially that's what they're saying. And again, important to place this in the context of a 50 or 70 year history where Israel captured East Jerusalem in 1967 and has been making the city more Israeli ever since that time. More Jewish Israelis have moved in. Israel has complete control of in terms of a government, in terms of security. But the Palestinians have always insisted that any sort of deal would require a Palestinian capital in East Jerusalem. And President Trump says that is not being ruled out, but this is clearly a very important symbolic step that he took by declaring Jerusalem the Israeli capital instead of the formulation that we've had for all these decades that it has to be negotiated and settled between the two parties.
Well, and Youssef Taha, certainly Israel has said that Jerusalem is an indivisible capital. David Friedman, the former bankruptcy attorney for President Trump, who is now ambassador, has talked about the importance of preserving these settlements. Underneath this move, is there pretty much a kind of not only fulfilling a campaign promise on the part of President Trump, but also seeing to it that what had been put into practice potentially by Congress is now fulfilled?
Well, but I have to remind you that Mr. Trump yesterday did not qualify it as indivisible capital of Israel. He said Jerusalem being the capital of Israel. And that is still open to interpretation as everything else in the Middle East, as you'd know.
Well, Israel, I said, sees Jerusalem as an indivisible capital. But I think that what we're talking about here is the possibility of President Trump not only keeping a campaign promise, but perhaps trying to reestablish a different kind of strategy in the Middle East. Can we assume that to any degree?
Possibly. I'm not a U.S. political affairs expert to comment on that.
Well, let me ask you to comment on something else, which is just the reaction in the Middle East. You've got the head of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, saying this will provoke Arabs and Muslims throughout the Western world, and there was just a good deal of amity between the United States with President Trump's visit to Saudi Arabia and Saudi Arabia.
But Mohammed bin Salman is not the head of Saudi Arabia. He is the crown prince.
All right.
While King Salman himself, he said this is regrettable and it is a terrible decision that is regrettable. So, Mohammed bin Salman himself has not made any comments since the announcement by Mr. Trump.
But the Saudi Arabian government has been speaking out, at least the leadership, against this capital, this move to the capital. And they've been speaking out very forcefully against it. And I'm wondering not only that, but even King Abdullah of Jordan. And I mean, we're getting very strong reaction from Erdogan and Turkey. What does it add up to in your mind? What does it really represent?
Well, one thing that is extremely crucial here to state that Jerusalem is an extremely, and I can't stress extremely enough, extremely emotive issue for Muslims, Arabs or non-Arabs, you see, Palestinians or others. But for all Muslims, it's an extremely emotive issue because Jerusalem is now the third holiest place in Islam. Muslims used to turn towards Jerusalem in their prayers until they were ordered by God to turn towards Mecca in Saudi Arabia. And that's one of the main reasons why it's so important for Muslims and emotive too. And therefore, to state that it is the capital of Israel as a complete departure from the status quo and from the UN's talk about final status negotiations is something that will not be accepted anywhere in the Middle East or in the Muslim world.
But Greg Myrie, just from the perspective of the United States, since 1995, Congress passed actually a law to move the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem, did they not?
That's true. And every 6 months, the president can sort of get around this by waiving it. And that's what's happened for more than 20 years. Every 6 months, presidents have waived this. And again, just going back in 1948, when Israel declared independence, President Harry Truman immediately recognized Israel, but he did not set up the embassy in Jerusalem. He set it up and it was in Tel Aviv and has been there ever since. So this policy really dates back to 1948. And that's been every presidential administration. The State Department has always taken this position. Congress has been very different. You've had a very pro-Israeli Congress where, in a bipartisan way, Democrats and Republicans have supported moves like this. And again, as you noted, in 1995, Congress overwhelmingly approved moving the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, and the president's had been waiving this until just yesterday.
So I'm wondering, and let me get a response from you on this, if I could, Greg. Robert Satloff, who actually writes for The Washington Post, but he's head of the Washington Institute, said that this will repair the historic error. He was trying to put a kind of a bright side on this move because of all the criticism it's come under. And he says that the presence for the Palestinian Authority in Jerusalem makes it unfair in many ways, tilts things against Israel.
Well, there is the reality. This has certainly been where Israel's government has operated since 48, since it became an independent, modern independent state. But, you know, this is the Middle East. Everything is negotiated. When the president announced this yesterday, the thing I was sort of looking for is, well, is he demanding something from Israel in return? Is he dangling something for the Palestinians? Is he hinting that they will get a capital in East Jerusalem in the future? Is he planning to tie this to some part of a larger strategy? And we really didn't see any of that. We saw the president give something to Israel, which Prime Minister Netanyahu and many Israelis support. It was a big prize for Israel. But I didn't see it connected to anything larger. And in fact, the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, is supposed to be working on a sort of peace, maybe not a plan, but at least his general ideas. This is really going to make his life even more difficult and undercut any proposal that comes forward. So it was sort of a one-way gift to Israel, if you will. And we'll have to see how it might have implications and ramifications we can't quite predict right now. But based on what we saw yesterday, it was something that Israel liked and pretty much the rest of the world opposes.
And that rest of the world will certainly affect relationships with the United States and allies and so forth. And I'm wondering, Yusuf Taha, if I can go back to you, because we have Secretary Mattis and Secretary Tillerson both talking about danger to diplomats and danger to troops in the Middle East and certainly danger, above all, to Muslim relations.
That's for sure, because apart from the danger to U.S. personnel, it's danger to U.S. interests in the Middle East and across the Muslim world. But more importantly as well, is a danger to peace in the Middle East. This adds more fuel to the fire, if you like. Situation is already tense. It has always been tense, worse these days. And if, as you rightly said, all U.S. presidents since 1948 have not called for Jerusalem to be the capital of Israel, that was for a reason. Don't tell me that all those presidents, successive presidents, were all wrong. They did that for a reason. They did not call for Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. They did not recognize it as such for a reason. And what you have now is an extremely volatile situation. Today was what I'd call the warm-up, but tomorrow is going to be the fireworks, tomorrow being Friday. So wait until after the Friday prayers, and you're going to see some fireworks, and I suspect there's going to be quite a bit of blood too. We had some demonstrations today in Palestinian territories, in Jerusalem, but also in Cairo, inside universities in Egypt. We had some more in Amman in Jordan. You had some in Pakistan, in Malaysia, and Indonesia too. So the U.S. and Israeli flags were burned. Pictures of President Trump were burned. And you're going to see a lot more to that effect tomorrow.
Yusuf Taha, again, is the BBC's Middle East desk, is with them. And I appreciate very much your being with us. We have to let you go, but I thank you for being with us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
And we're going to continue with Greg Myrie, who is National Security Correspondent for National Public Radio, and with you, our listeners. In fact, if you have some thoughts that you would like to bring to the table here, so to speak, or if you have some questions or comments for Greg, we'd like to hear from you, thoughts particularly reflecting on the status of what's going on as we're speaking here. There is more fire to come, unfortunately. I think we would agree with Yusuf Taha because it's been called for by many in the Middle East. But you may have some thoughts, and if so, we'd like to hear from you. Questions or comments? You can join us toll-free right now at 866-733-6786. Again, please join us, 866-733-6786. There are a number of other ways you can bring your questions and your comments and thoughts to us by email, forum@kqed.org. That's forum@kqed.org. Or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @kqedforum. And listeners are raising questions. You don't have a crystal ball, I know, Greg, but how many people are going to die as a result of this, or how much more terror is going to result? Big questions now that loom, don't they?
Absolutely. I certainly don't want to predict on what might happen. There's a lot of anger in the streets. We're seeing that in the West Bank and in Gaza today. Friday prayers, as we noted, will be a big deal tomorrow. And certainly we're keeping an eye on unrest. But I think the larger issue will simply be how the U.S. is perceived in the region, because they're getting a lot of criticism from U.S. allies, friendly countries, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and others are criticizing. So that's at the official level among U.S. allies, to say nothing of adversaries or radical groups that will use this as a rallying cry against the United States. So it's not just part of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It's something that's absolutely part of the much broader Middle East reality and the way that the U.S. will be perceived.
I would say, though, it's probably most fraught at the borders and with security and Palestinian refugees. But what about within Jerusalem itself? I mean, there are certainly a lot of Arab citizens who live in Jerusalem under the Israeli government. And the reality is that a lot of them probably are going to be reacting to this just the way their brothers and sisters are.
Yeah, sure. Now, historically, the Arabs that live in Israel are about 20% of the population. They have not been involved in a lot of the violence historically. We have seen in the past year or two a number of the stabbing incidents have involved them. So we've seen a bit of a rise in that. But generally, the more serious clashes have involved Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza. But East Jerusalem, which was 100% Arab in 1967 when Israel took it over, is still mostly Arab-Palestinian. A lot of Jewish Israelis have moved there, but the city is still the eastern part of the city is still majority Palestinian. They're going to be very upset about this. And tomorrow we'll have Friday prayers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, one of the holiest sites in Islam. And it'll be a very tense moment as people hold those prayers and then leave the prayer scene afterwards.
We're talking with Greg Myrie, who is with us from Washington, national security correspondent with National Public Radio. And he was based in Jerusalem from 2000 to 2007, talking about President Trump's recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. And let me go to your calls, and let's go first to David. David, join us. You're on the air.
Yeah, how are you, Michael? I'm kind of surprised that the tone has turned instantly to who's going to be more violent. That's far from what's really going on. Since Jared and Trump are both real estate developers, I'm betting that they've already got the place carved out, that zoning is going to go to them, that the real estate interests are going to move in like, zombies, like they've done with this city. So I'm just wondering, is there any proof of Jared's financial arrangements with this development plan?
Greg Myrie, have you found anything along those lines? I know that, this is going to protect the settlement development, certainly, won't it?
Right. Well, a lot of issues we could unpack there. I'm not aware of any major Trump or Trump family financial developments in this particular. I will point out one thing. I arrived there in 2000, and just before the last big Palestinian uprising, sparked by a visit by Ariel Sharon to the contentious religious sites there. And at that time, there was this notion that a peace deal was close and countries were quite eager to look at real estate both in West Jerusalem and East Jerusalem, thinking there would be the capitals would be established there and you would need an embassy, two embassies in Jerusalem, one for the Israelis in West Jerusalem, another for the Palestinians in East Jerusalem.
That was the end of the two-state solution, basically, wasn't it?
Well, the point at which they got close and then it all blew up, yeah. Yes, and we haven't really been close since then. So again, I'm not aware of any big real estate projects. Jerusalem real estate is quite expensive. The economy on the Israeli side has done pretty well, but I see this more as part of the president dealing with campaign promises rather than diplomacy or real estate.
Well, and also, here's a tweet that says, Trump doesn't have the brains for strategy. His Jerusalem stance is merely a bone he's tossing to his evangelical base here. And Bill writes, I'm disappointed in the news reporting presenting this as only a policy topic within the U.S. This should be seen as politics with certain Zionist and Christian groups flexing their political muscle and finally prevailing after decades of pressure. How many members of the House of Representatives would have to go against their aggressive constituents? How much is this evangelicals and strong AIPAC type of people here?
I think that is certainly a part of it. This was something that Trump and, to be fair, other presidential candidates have a pledge they've made that they would move the embassy. So Trump was not the first to promise this. He's the first to deliver on it. And the pressure came primarily from very conservative Jewish groups in the U.S., from evangelicals in the U.S., and obviously many in Israel, not everybody, but many in Israel, particularly on the more hawkish side or conservative side, wanted this. So, yeah, I see it more as part of this political game that's going on because, again, as I said, having watched this for two decades or so, you know, it's always a negotiation. There's going to be trade-offs. So Israel's going to get this prize. What are they going to have to give up? What are they going to have to pledge? What's being offered to the Palestinian? All those elements were not part of it. It was really just, seemed to be Trump playing to his supporters in this case, based on what we've seen so far.
Well, one of our listeners, Mike, makes a good point here. He says the Middle East peace process has been stalled since Rabin's assassination in 1995. Maybe this move is drastic enough to jumpstart it. Your thoughts on that, Greg?
Well, you know, what was interesting is the notion of sort of flipping the script here. Instead of waiting for these two sides to negotiate a settlement, which they haven't been able to do in over more than 20 years with the U.S. and others brokering these talks, you know, do it the other way. Could the U.S. declare Jerusalem is the Israeli capital, East Jerusalem is the Palestinian capital, recognize a Palestinian state even before it's agreed to? Could you do it that way? So I think there is a sense people would welcome new and fresh ideas. But again, this was not – there has to be some sense that both sides are getting something, that it's breeding an atmosphere of cooperation and trust. And again, many Israelis are very happy with this, but the Palestinians are hugely disappointed. So it's not really generating momentum for cooperation. It seems to be creating more an atmosphere of friction.
But despite talk to the contrary, hasn't there still been some real serious division between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority? I mean, they're not at one, really, are they?
Well, they've been divided for more than a decade now, fought a nasty battle 2007, and the Palestinian Authority and the Fatah movement control the West Bank, Hamas controls Gaza. But just recently, they have reached an understanding to sort of work together and have a unified face. And the Palestinian Authority, with their leader, Mahmoud Abbas, will reassert itself in Gaza. And we're already hitting some snags, and we'll have to see how that's going to play out. Other attempts have failed in the past. the Palestinians are making a serious effort, again, to try to be as one. And again, that's been a huge problem because the Israelis have often said, who do we negotiate with when you have two separate leaderships, one in the West Bank, one in Gaza? How can we make a deal? We make a deal with one, but the other won't observe it. So we'll have to see if the Palestinians can pull it off this time. And again, don't see the Israel as monolithic. There are Israelis that don't support the move by President Trump, who see this as detrimental to ultimately working out a peaceful solution.
I should also mention that Mahmoud Abbas's leadership is fairly fragile and shaky, and at this point, I think it's safe to say that there may be things that will turn the corner for Benjamin Netanyahu, too. There have been, you know, some serious adjudication of things that he's been involved in. But let me get some more callers on here, and let's get Ali on next. Ali, go ahead.
Hi, I just want to make a comment about Trump's behavior, that he always pick an issue that is kind of tricky and sensitive, and then by initiating this sort of like a reactionary sort of like environment, then he'll wait for some sort of incident, unfortunately, like a killing or a bombing, and then he'll going to say, oh, that's why I told you, that's why we have to close the border, that's why we have to have a Muslim ban. It's sort of like justifying what he is preaching, and he's been doing that all throughout his life, sort of like, you know, chaotic environment and benefit from that. I get my response back up.
Yeah, well, Ali, I thank you. That was a comment. You want to respond to him at all, Greg? Greg Myrie?
Yeah, sure. That it is such a sensitive place. And again, I witnessed this firsthand in 2000 when the Israeli opposition leader, Ariel Sharon, made a visit to the Haram al-Sharif, the Muslim holy site. It's also a Jewish holy site, the site of the ancient temples that were destroyed. The very next day, we saw Palestinian rioting and a five-year uprising. And again, it's not fair to blame all of that on that one visit, but it did spark the initial riots, and it showed how fragile the Middle East is and how explosive it can be. I'm not predicting that kind of reaction here. We'll have to wait and see. We've seen a lot of anger. I think the Israeli security forces are much better positioned to limit the Palestinian response at this stage. The Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian leader, has always opposed violence. Hamas in Gaza is calling for a new intifada. So there is this fragility, and this is certainly challenging it.
Here's Chuck. Chuck, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Thank you. I just want to bring up an important question, which is that according to the United Nations Charter, you are not allowed to take territory by force. So when East Jerusalem was occupied in 1967, and Israel declared that it was the capital, the undivided capital of Israel, that was rejected by the entire world because of the UN Charter saying you can't take territory by force and call it yours. So this whole thing is just the law of the jungle. The U.S. can do what they want because nobody can say anything about it. But the rest of the world, rightfully, in my opinion, believes that that Jerusalem cannot be given to the Israelis in totality because it's against international law, which should mean something, we hope.
Well, I'm reading a comment here, and I thank you for your comments, Chuck, from Noel, who says, I heard years ago about making Jerusalem an international city in that no one group could claim it as its own, and she wants to know what happened to that idea. It sort of got lost in the shuffle here, Greg, it's safe to say.
Yeah, good point. So as the British were leaving in 1947 and they had to figure out what to do with the Holy Land, the United Nations came up with this partition plan, and it called for an Israel, a Palestine, with Jerusalem being called a corpus separatum or a separate body. It was going to be an international city, probably run by the United Nations or some such body. And therefore, no country could claim the city because they realized the sensitivities for Muslims, Jews, and Christians. That plan was actually approved by the United Nations. However, the fighting broke out. It never took effect, and you had got West Jerusalem with Israel and East Jerusalem, which Jordan controlled at that time. It stayed that way from 48 to 67 when the 67 war came and Israel took all of the city. And as Chuck pointed out, the statuses of the city has never been resolved. It's supposed to be negotiated. You're not allowed to take territory by force. And that's where we've been for the past half century.
And let me read some listener comments. Ben writes, Jerusalem is the most important site for Jews around the world. Israel's whole government and culture is based out of Jerusalem. Since peace negotiations are basically dead, what's the difference? And Peter writes, now that President Trump has recognized reality by recognizing Israel's long-functioning capital in Jerusalem, might this not be a wonderful opportunity to locate a functioning Palestinian capital there? And Noel says, all I can figure is that Sheldon Adelson, the billionaire, has been leaning on Trump about the embassy. I don't understand why some evangelical Christians support this, but that's what I hear. And let me bring more of your calls on. We go next to Nancy. Nancy, join us.
Hi. You know, this is kind of Trump's, my opinion, modus operandi. He loves to inflame situations. To me, this is no different than the warships and the war games that they're playing near North Korea. He just likes sticking the stick into somebody's eye. And this is another inflaming the situation. And if he was really interested in diffusing, you know, war situations, he would take his warships and games away from North Korea, and he would never have done this about Jerusalem. He would insist that Israel stops building settlements and try to settle peacefully, but this is not the way he likes to do things.
Nancy, appreciate your comments. He could reverse this, though, at this point, couldn't he, or within the next 6 months, Greg?
He could. I certainly wouldn't expect that right now. The point I think that I would make is it's going to be a very long process. The U.S. has built within the past decade a pretty large consulate in Jerusalem, and that deals two of my daughters were born in Jerusalem. We had to go there to get American passports for them. Jerusalem residents, Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza go to this consulate to get visas to travel to the U.S. So there was a thinking that that might become the embassy, but he said yesterday they were going to find a new place, build the embassy, and that's a process that will take years.
Will they build a wall? We have to wait and see, but they're talking about building an embassy. Greg, appreciate very much your being with us. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Michael.
Greg Myrie, again, National Security Correspondent for National Public Radio, based in Jerusalem from 2000 to 2007. We're based right here in San Francisco. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Gucci, and Tina Larberg. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer is Steve Asrigado. Engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with help from Devin Holt. And we get online support from Amanda Font. Interns are Anna Sterling, Patrick Fitzgerald, managing editor Ethan Lindsay, executive producer Holly Kernan. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.